Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, Pennsylvania's capital was the scene of a political insurrection in 1838. We'll learn about that history. But up front, Pennsylvania state legislators are considering a move that would change the way appellate judges are elected to the courts. Currently, judges who are running for Supreme, Superior, and Commonwealth Court are elected statewide. The proposed legislation would allow voters to elect them by district. This would be a Pennsylvania constitutional amendment, and in order to be changed, the legislation must pass both the House and Senate in two consecutive terms before going to voters as a referendum. Some of that has already occurred. Republican State Representative Russ Diamond of Lebanon County is the sponsor of this legislation. Representative Diamond, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Representative, this legislation, as I said, would be a constitutional amendment, would elect appellate court judges by district. Why do you think a change is needed?
A change is needed, Scott, because over the last 50 years in Pennsylvania, two counties with only 21.8% of Pennsylvania's population have sent residents to fill the seats on these courts at a rate of nearly 60%, nearly triple their population share. And what we need to do is we need to have the vast diversity of Pennsylvania have a voice on these courts where statutes are heard on appeal and set legal precedent for the future. We're talking about diversification of the voices who are on the courts.
Of course, you're referring to Philadelphia and Allegheny County, the two most populated counties in Pennsylvania. The law is the law, and obviously different judges interpret it differently. But why should a judge, where they're from, have anything to do with how they make decisions?
Well, for the same reason that we come to statewide consensus when we create statutory law in the General Assembly, that same kind of diversity of thought and experience and opinion ought to come into play when these laws are practically applied on appeal and when we're setting legal precedent for the future.
Are you still there, Representative? All right, I think we've lost Representative Diamond's. Okay, are you there now?
I am here now.
Okay, yeah. Folks, as you realize, over the past 10 months, we've been doing this remotely, and from time to time, some of these remote broadcasts, we'll see someone freeze up. But I think you were cut off right there at the end. But, Representative, one thing I want to bring up is that a judge is different than a legislator. Legislators make laws. Judges interpret laws. How would, again, I'm going to kind of refrain or ask that question again. The diversity is a good thing, but where someone is from, how would that be? They would have so much of a different opinion on how to interpret a law.
Well, just let me give you one, for instance, and that's our right to bear arms in Pennsylvania. There's a vastly different opinion on that from somebody who hails from an urban area than from a rural area. And both those opinions, whether you agree with them or not, they're legitimate approaches to the law, and those voices ought to be heard when those laws are heard on appeal or setting precedent for the future.
Again, Second Amendment is what dictates the Second Amendment of the Constitution when you using your example.
Scott, let me interrupt you there.
Okay,
Pennsylvania. The Second Amendment does not come into play when Pennsylvania courts hear the law. It is Article 1, Section 2, or Section 21 of the Pennsylvania Constitution, which is vastly different than the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, is what comes to play when Pennsylvania gun laws are heard.
But again, I bring this question up. How would a judge from Philadelphia rule differently than one from, say, Juniata County, that constitution, that part of the constitution, Pennsylvania's constitution?
Well, I would certainly point out the efforts in Pittsburgh to ban particular guns, which would never, ever happen in Juniata County. Those are done by people who were born and raised in Pittsburgh and not born and raised in Juniata County. So the approach to the law itself and the approach to the Constitution differs vastly across Pennsylvania's many, many different regions.
I'm not familiar with Pittsburgh attempting to ban firearms. I know that there have been municipalities that wanted to enact their own laws. But let's get on to some other issues here. Who will decide?
And that's exactly my point. You would never see that in Juniata County. You would never see an effort like that in Juniata County. And just as politicians are crafted within the environment they live in, judges are as well. And we need those various different opinions on our courts, Scott.
Who would decide how the districts are drawn up?
The districts would be drawn by the General Assembly because we haven't reached consensus on the way to change our redistricting process. However, that would have to be done by a law, which would have to be signed by the governor. So if those who oppose this plan don't trust the governor to not approve a quote unquote gerrymandered map, well, then that's on them.
Isn't this in response, or is it in response to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's recent rulings that Republicans simply don't like, ruling that congressional districts were gerrymandered to favor Republican candidates and some of the rulings in the recent election?
That is a red herring argument. This effort to create appellate court districts is not a recent effort. I have had this bill in the General Assembly for four consecutive sessions, long before the Supreme Court unlawfully drew their own congressional districts or unlawfully undermined the election law that we created in the General Assembly. This effort actually stretches back to 1989, when J. Doyle Corman, who was a senator, had Senate Bill 1300 with this plan. After that, Robert B. Surik, a candidate for Supreme Court and Superior Court judge in Pennsylvania in the early 1990s, championed this plan as well. And this plan was a recommendation in the aftermath of the Rolf Larsen impeachment process. So this is not a new plan to try to address a contemporary problem. As I stated earlier, this problem stretches back 51 years to when the Commonwealth Court first was formed. And I will note that when the Commonwealth Court was first formed in 1969, Governor Raymond Schaefer went to great lengths to make sure that regional diversity was represented among the first appointees to that court. However, we've gone downhill since then, and just on the Commonwealth Court, 42% of all those seats are held by people from two counties, with only 21.8% of Pennsylvania's population.
Okay, it is kind of ironic, though, when we're talking about gerrymandering, because one of the criticisms of this legislation is that the judicial districts will be drawn up to favor the majority party in the legislature, who will draw the boundaries, thus making the judicial district's judges more political. How do you answer that?
I will pin the lie to those lips who have uttered that, by just reminding you that that law drawing the maps has to be approved by the governor of Pennsylvania, who happens to be a Democrat right now. Now, when people talk about gerrymandering, Scott, I know that map drawing comes into play, but the real injury from gerrymandering is when one particular segment of Pennsylvania's population is overrepresented in the halls of government at the expense of another segment of the population. And that can happen, as it has happened with our appellate court judges, without any map drawing at all. So this plan is really a cure to the real injury of gerrymandering without any map drawing at all.
Would you agree that you kind of touched on this, but that we do need some reforms, not just with the judicial branch, but how we draw up boundaries for congressional districts and legislative districts?
Yes, I do agree with that. And quite frankly, that's why I was a co-sponsor last year of a Jim Gregory's bill, House Bill 2327, which was a bipartisan bill to create a new commission to draw congressional districts and such. However, I am under the understanding that once that bill got into the state government committee, the Democrats met on that bill and their leadership told them that we don't need a new plan to draw the lines because we always have the Supreme Court to get our backs if the lines are drawn wrong. I
Who
think
did you
that's
hear that from?
A horrendous approach to the way we draw lines in Pennsylvania.
I have no way of proving that happened. Who did you hear that from?
I heard that from Democratic members of the House of Representatives.
Okay. Another criticism is that the judges elected from districts will be beholden to their constituents, people who elected them, and that they will make rulings based on getting elected or making the voters in their district happy. Judges are not supposed to have constituents.
Well, that's actually a straw man argument as well, Scott, because these judges will still be elected to serve lengthy 10-year terms. And then after that 10-year term is up, we'll stand for a simple yes or no retention vote for another 10-year term. If you look back in history, there has only been one appellate court judge in the history of Pennsylvania who has not been retained at a retention election. And I happen to have personal knowledge of that. That was Russell Nigro, and I was instrumental in that effort to unseat him. Judges do not lose retention elections. Therefore, the straw man argument, it is obvious that they will be, beholden to any particular constituency. Judges don't have constituencies. Their constituency is the law.
Okay, well, if that goes back to one of my original questions then, if that be the case, what does it matter where they're from?
It matters where they're from because we have different experiences across Pennsylvania. Look, I've had the benefit of running three statewide campaigns in Pennsylvania, and anyone who has done that could easily tell you that Pennsylvania could easily be divided into seven different states with different traditions, beliefs, values, and judicial philosophies when it comes to interpreting the Constitution. All those voices need to be fairly heard on our appellate courts in Pennsylvania.
Now, granted, most judges are elected from Philadelphia, Allegheny County, but that doesn't go to how we elect judges. They can't talk about issues. People learn about them through TV commercials or party endorsements for the most part. Most voters don't recognize their names, and really they don't have a whole lot of ways of knowing about a judge's record, although I've received a few emails here from listeners saying that I study up on this before an election. If you wanted real reform, why not support reform that every former governor of this state and the majority of other states utilize, and that is appointing judges rather than electing them?
Because ultimately, although I take great pride in the legislation I push through the General Assembly and the governor signs into law, once that law becomes law, the law belongs to the people. And only the people should decide who hears those laws on appeal or sets legal precedent for the future. The plan that you recommended or talked about by those governors is really a plan to secretly politicize the courts, to bury the choice of who becomes a judge in a 13-member panel dominated by eight lawyers and political appointees. If you want smoke-filled rooms where backroom deals are made, your favorite plan is merit selection. But if you want a judiciary that is responsive to the will of the people, true, democratic fashion, you want to select your judges from regional districts in Pennsylvania.
Only two other states elect judges by district, Louisiana and Illinois. But what you just talked about with the merit selection of judges, the majority of states in this country do it that way. On the federal level, federal judges are appointed by the president with recommendations from the senators in that state. The president appoints the Supreme Court justices. So how's Pennsylvania any different How would Pennsylvania be any different? I mean, is there smoke filled rooms in all these places?
Actually, there is smoke filled rooms in all those places. And, you know, the nature of your question reminds me of the old thing my mom used to tell me when I was the bridge. Are you going to follow them or are you going to use your common sense? Look, if you want to bury these things in smoke filled rooms, please assign it to some politically appointed panel. And you, as a voter, you're never going to have any say over who becomes a judge of the law in Pennsylvania. Look, we do this in every county in Pennsylvania. We elect those judges regionally. They rule on laws of statewide nature all the time. It should be no different for our appellate courts.
We have several emails here, Representative. I want to pass this along. It strikes me that the Republican legislative effort to regionalize appellate court districts is but one more attempt to voter disenfranchisement. Since the loss of a Supreme Court majority and its influence in calling them on redistricting, Republican legislators have been seeking ways to keep their gerrymandered advantage because they know they cannot win otherwise. Call it what it is, a power grab. You've addressed this, but what do you say to that listener?
It is amazing that people are using the term disenfranchisement, especially from groups like Pennsylvania's for Modern Courts, whose ultimate goal is to go to merit selection, which would disenfranchise every single voter in Pennsylvania. I'm amazed that they have tried to pull this, you know, rabbit out of a hat to throw it up to a point to oppose a plan which would actually enfranchise the rural residents of Pennsylvania a little bit more and end the injury, which ultimately becomes of gerrymandering, which is overrepresentation of one segment of the population to the disadvantage of another segment of our population.
We have another listener. It says, I'm a lawyer in central Pennsylvania. I grew up in Bradford County, Pennsylvania. It is incredibly insulting to hear your guest proposals implying judicial candidates from rural areas cannot compete with candidates from more urban areas on their own merits. Look to newly elected state treasurer Stacey Garrity. Federal Judge Brand was appointed by President Trump. These are two examples of Bradford County natives who made it into their positions on the merits of their work.
That's fine, but that is not our appellate courts in Pennsylvania. The reality is that those rural judges do not get a shot at being elected to our appellate courts in Pennsylvania. And, you know, the governor or the Department of Health or the Department of State, I'm providing my data to the public. Look at the data I've provided, which lists where these judges have come from over the last 51 years. The rural perspective is not being heard on these courts.
Representative, we're going to be hearing from a group that opposes this legislation in just a few minutes. But I did want to change the topic before in just a few minutes that we have left. We are in the middle of a pandemic. You've been one of the most outspoken members of the legislature against wearing a mask during this pandemic. I saw you yesterday at a hearing not wearing a mask while most of your colleagues did. Why won't you wear a mask?
I don't know that that's related to judicial districts, is it?
I know it's not. But I just said, it's something that
Scott, I came on your program to talk about a very important issue to Pennsylvanians regarding our judicial districts. If you want to talk about that, I'm glad to come on another episode when you want to talk about health initiatives and that sort of thing.
But you won't answer questions of just why you won't wear a mask?
I'm here to talk about judicial districts and House Bill 38. If that interview is over, I'm free to sign off. It's not a problem.
Okay. Well, then we will talk about that sometime, Representative. Representative Russ Diamond, who is a Republican from Lebanon County, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Monday, Smart Talk, we're going to be talking with the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania about their legislative priorities for counties in Pennsylvania, and also what they would like to see as far as Pennsylvania's elections, changes in how elections are run here in Pennsylvania. That's coming up on Monday's program. The legislation to elect appellate court judges by districts rather than statewide is opposed by good government groups and those that advocate for court reforms. One of those organizations is Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, and we're joined now by the president and CEO, Debbie Gross. Ms. Gross, welcome to the program.
Thank you so very much for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I know that you just heard Representative Diamond, and you're familiar with this legislation. Why do you and your organization, Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, oppose this bill?
For many reasons. You know, one is it affects the impact, or it impacts the ability of a judge to be independent. As you know, Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts is a strong proponent of merit appointment, and this is the complete opposite. This is holding judges accountable, right? This is narrowing who gets to vote for a judge. It's disenfranchising, and it's really misleading. A judge's location, geographic location, does not lessen or make a judge more diverse, right? You know, it's interesting because the bill itself, the language in the bill, only requires a candidate for judge to live in that district for 1 year preceding the election. So judges could, you know, move around people could move around to a district in order to be elected. So what diversity a potential judge brings, or a candidate brings, is not based on where they reside, but it's based on their own personal experience, where they went to law school, where they grew up. You know, they could have lived in another state, another country for years, and we have that now.
But okay, something you just said, it's based on their experience of where they grew up. That sounds exactly what Representative Diamond is saying as well, is that someone who grew up in a rural area or outside of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh would have a different experience. And I ask the same question to you. Shouldn't judges be making their decisions based on the law, not their experiences?
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that to the contrary. Judges take an oath to the Constitution, to the law, to apply them fairly across the state. So that all I was trying to point out was that it's misleading to say that geographic diversity will make is something that is lacking in the court. We have diversity on the court. Fair minority participation on this court, but we do have diversity on this court based on where all these judges grew up, where they went to law school, you know, but we are more focused on really how they interpret the law and the Constitution and, you know, and following precedent. And those are the areas that the judge is obligated to follow.
The point that Representative Diamond and supporters of this bill will make, and I mean one of the points, is that the majority of appellate court judges in this state now and historically have been from the population centers of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And actually, most of the candidates are from those two areas as well. I mean, that would seem to be an issue. I mean, we have this great rural urban divide in Pennsylvania and really across the country. I think the last presidential election bore that out. But are there too many candidates, too many judges from those population centers?
I don't think so. I don't think we should be looking at population centers, but we do have a Supreme Court justice from Tioga County. We do have on our Commonwealth Court three judges from Dauphin County. If Representative Diamond's bill were to pass, we would not be having three candidates from Dauphin County on Commonwealth Court.
You know, I'll bring up some of the issues that I brought up with him as well and get your thoughts on it, that doing this would make it ripe for political gerrymandering, that this could be judicial districts and judges could be subject to more politics than what they are now. Is that something that you feel that would be a result of this if it were to happen?
Yes, we do. I mean, Pennsylvania's for Modern Courts was created because of concern for judges running for positions. Money, you know, can have bad influence, right? And we, in the last election, you know, there's now increases in dark money and PACs. So now this is an even stronger concern when you have elections that occur by district and there can be monies that are brought into each specific district.
Two states, Louisiana and Illinois, elect judges by district, appellate court judges. Are you familiar with what their experiences have been?
So they have done that for a while. Again, they do not have, you know, their states are different compositions, and so that we can't really compare it. We would be changing our districting based on the census. Those are districts that are set. So it is not comparable, but they are not held up to be, courts that should be modeled. There's a Brennan Center for Justice and the National Court State Center, something that also, you know, have studied this and do not hold up those states as models to follow.
Representative Diamond said that, because as you said, Pennsylvania's for Modern Courts, you've long advocated for merit selection of judges. He said that if Pennsylvania were to go to this, that it would be filled with smoke-filled rooms. Can you respond to that? I mean, in other words, what he's talking about is that some powerful politicians would be deciding who would be judges.
And that's not accurate either. And, you know, if that's his issue also, he could help change and form the commission. But currently the bill that stands is the appointment of an independent nominating commission that has lawyers and non-lawyers, has representatives from both parties, and is the model that this was was something that was proposed again by the Brennan Center, which has studied merit appointment commissions across the country. So this is a model that is upheld as exemplary and is a bipartisan commission. It includes non-lawyers. I mean, it is a very a fair and even proposal.
But is there, I mean, I've heard people, you know, we've talked about this for a long time, merit selection of judges, that if it was to occur, that there really is no way, even though what you just described, non-lawyers, bipartisan, but there really is no way to get politics out of the whole situation.
You know, the federal judges are appointed by commissions. They in Pennsylvania, we have a commission that is chaired by both by nominees from each of our senators. We have one Republican senator right now, one Democratic senator. They have proposed judges who, you know, are Democrats and are Republicans. One can always say politics will be in the process, but the focus here is on the qualifications and the merit of judges, of candidates, of judicial candidates.
I know I'm jumping around on you here, but how we elect judges now, as I've described, is that most voters are not familiar with the candidates. There are rules, there are limitations as to what a judicial candidate can say. They can't campaign like a normal candidate for city council or for legislator or even governor. They can't talk about how they would rule on certain cases. That's why we hear so many TV commercials about, I'm a tough and fair judge. I joke all the time. The first one that says, I'm not very tough and I'm not real fair, that's going to be the one that sticks out. Anyway, you know, you when judges, judicial candidates run for office today, it seems like a cumbersome situation that that voters don't know a whole lot about these candidates. But at the same time, you know, Representative Diamond said that if you had a commission or you went to merit selection judges, you would disenfranchise voters, that you would take the right to vote for judges away from them. How do you respond to that?
So I'm going to take this in a few parts, if you don't mind.
No, sure.
So first, with respect to educating people about judges, you know, because they cannot answer questions about how they would rule, it's really important to know that the various bar associations, the Philadelphia Bar Association, the Allegheny County Bar Association, the Pennsylvania Bar Association, thoroughly vet judges, judicial candidates. They have commissions that are comprised, they are not politically based. They are comprised of various groups of organizations, lawyers and non-lawyers, and they vet judges. They actually, on Friday afternoons, because I was a member of the Philadelphia Bar Association's Judicial Selection Committee, Selection and Retention Committee. We vet, we discuss them, we interview them, we actually do background checks, we interview their, we read their opinion, you know, cases, if they are lawyers, or if they are not, if they're lawyers that litigate, we read their briefs, we speak to over 30 different, you know, references, and the Bar Association make recommendations. So that is number one. It's really important because they issue them. They're available now on your iPhone, so you can do some research. So there is now information out there about judicial candidates. With respect to the disenfranchising voter argument, the issue here is that we currently vote for 31 different judges. If this bill were to pass, we would only be voting for three. By contrast, for a merit appointment, you are electing your representatives, your governor, to make that decision with respect to all 31 judges or all seven judges or 15 and 10, nine. So you aren't disenfranchised because you're still having a say because you get to elect your official, your representative, your governor, who is involved in the merit selection. Here, that's not happening. I'm not electing a representative who will then make a decision on 28 other judges. So I am being disenfranchised.
We're almost out of time, Ms. Gross. So what do you think happens from here? I mean, as we said, as a constitutional amendment has to pass both the houses of the legislature, branches of the legislature, two consecutive sessions, and there's a possibility that it could be on the May ballot because it has already passed one.
I want to explain, if you know, the process that this bill was passed recently is really, you know, it was rushed. There was no hearing, no testimony, no experts, no public coming to testify. This was something that has been rushed through with the goal of trying to be put on the May ballot because the question in the bill is confusing. It doesn't explain how people vote right now. Voters don't turn out for the May ballot, and Pennsylvanians typically vote yes for constitutional amendments. So this will have to be, you know, all this information has to get out to the public. They need to reach out to their legislators. They need to understand what this means and how it affects them, that, you know, there could potentially be some litigation over this. So it is not yet over.
Debbie Gross is president and CEO of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for asking me to join you. I very much appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. 2 weeks ago, the United States Capitol was the scene of a violent insurrection. Pennsylvania State Capitol was the scene of a violent insurrection in 1838 during what was called the Buckshot War. Let's learn more about that history today. Joining us is Carlisle Sentinel reporter and author of the book Hidden History of Cumberland County, Joseph Kress. Mr. Kress, welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you today?
I'm doing well. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. All right, so there are parallels between what happened at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th and the rowdy mob at the Pennsylvania Capitol in Harrisburg in December 1838. It became known as the Buckshot War. What happened in 1838?
Well, I jotted down some notes of what the parallels were, so I just wanted to go over the list here. Both incidents were sparked by a dispute over election returns from Pennsylvania. In the Buckshot War, the debate centered around the outcome of key races in certain Philadelphia precincts, where the Democrats claimed they had the majority, won the majority. In the Washington incident, the electoral votes from Pennsylvania were in dispute. In both cases, members of the mob made death threats against the leader of the Senate. In the Buckshot War, the mob threatened to drench the Senate chamber in blood and to assassinate Senate Speaker Charles Bingham Penrose. In the case of Washington, the mob threatened to hang Mike Pence. Now, Pence at the time was the U.S. Vice President, who also served as the President of the U.S. Senate. In both cases, the mob entered the Senate chamber of the Capitol building. In the Buckshot War, the mob was already in the chamber. They were on the floor, they were in the gallery, and they were outside in the lobby. So they were in the audience as part of the proceedings that day. In the case of Washington, the mob broke into the Capitol building and then entered the Senate chamber. In both cases, the leader of the Senate had to flee for his life. In the Buckshot War, the mob grew so unruly that Penrose had to flee out of a back room behind the Senate dais, out a window, and down a ladder into the night. In the case of Washington, the security fought a delaying action that gave Mike Pence and others in the Senate enough warning to retreat to a safer location. In both cases, citizen soldiers were called in to patrol and protect not just the Capitol building, but the Capitol city. In the Buckshot War, it was the Pennsylvania State Militia, which included units from Carlisle and Mechanicsburg. In the case of Washington, it was the National Guard, which is the modern equivalent of the militia. In both cases, there was a media spin centered around who was in the mob. Depending on who was reporting and interpreting the news, the mob was either a gang of insurrectionists or a band of patriots. Sound familiar?
Yeah, a lot of those.
In both cases... Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I just said, yeah, a lot of this sounds familiar.
So, and also in both cases, there was like evidence to suggest that the words and the deeds of a controversial political figure incited the mob to violence. In the case of the Buckshot War, Charles Bingham Penrose, who was a Whig, refused to yield the floor to Democrat Charles Brown, who wanted to give a speech. Now that snub irritated an already irritable crowd that only made the situation in the Senate chamber worse. In the case of Washington, the Washington incident, the speech by Donald Trump is believed to have served as the trigger to his supporters, the trigger that his supporters needed to storm the Capitol building. So while there are some similarities, what was also interesting is it can be argued that both political parties involved in the incident were responsible for inciting the mob at the Buckshot War.
All right, let's talk about that a little.
On the Senate floor.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because Democrats and Whigs at the time, there wasn't a Republican Party at the time, but Democrats and, yes. and Whigs, you touched on this, but what was each side saying about the other? Obviously, you know, I think it's, when you talk about similarities, that when you're talking about some seats being contested in Philadelphia, again, that sounds very familiar here as well. But what was each side saying?
Well, the Democrats were saying that the Whigs were trying to defraud the election. And that, you know, the Whigs were saying, no, we were not. So it's like, that's basically what it was in a nutshell.
And each accused the other of promoting or starting this insurrection. I don't know if we can call it an insurrection or not. I mean, it sounds like it was a very rowdy, could be violent mob when you had legislators who were fleeing for their lives, but that each side was accusing the other of sending their people or people who supported their cause to Harrisburg to disrupt the legislative proceedings, correct?
Yes. There was evidence to suggest that, you know, again, depending on who you talk to, the Whigs believe that the Democrats deliberately sent muscle from the Philadelphia area into Harrisburg to try to intimidate the Whigs into seating the Democrats. And the Democrats believed that because Governor Rittner funded a lot of public infrastructure projects, that some of the companies that benefited from those contracts sent help to Harrisburg to keep him in power, because he was giving them money. And he was, you know, basically using public money to fund those infrastructure projects. So again, depending on who you talk, who is saying what, you know, the mob was this, you know, thugs from Philadelphia in the case of the Whigs, in the case of the Democrats, they also believe that the mob might have been workers sent from the companies that were benefiting from Rittner's policies. Some of the other Democrats believe that the mob that showed up and was in the Senate chamber were patriots. I mean, they saw this attempt by the Whigs to, you know, usurp the rights of voters, and they wanted to stop that. So it's like, again, sound familiar?
How did the name Buckshot War, how did this incident get the name Buckshot War?
The name Buckshot War related to the ammunition that was issued to the militia troops who were sent in to kind of quell the uprising or the political upheaval. That's where kind of like Cumberland County comes in. The story that I wrote in the Sentinel is basically based on a chapter that I wrote in my book, Hidden History of Cumberland County. And naturally, I had to tie in Cumberland County history to the Buckshot War. And three of the companies of militia that showed up that were basically dispatched to Harrisburg were from Carlisle. And there were a couple of units from Mechanicsburg as well. There was an attempt by Penrose, Senator Penrose, and Governor Rittner to ask the commandant or the captain, the commander of the troops at the Carlisle barracks, to send those federal troops to help quell the insurrection. That's what they called it, an insurrection. And that the commander of the Carlisle barracks refused to send troops because he didn't want to get his troops involved in the fray between these two political parties. He wanted to basically keep them out of it. Rittner and Penrose were not pleased by that outcome. Then he's decided, okay, well, they're going to contact Martin Van Buren, who was the president of the United States at the time. And he also refused because of the same reason. He didn't want to involve federal troops in a state issue.
So you had a lot of people in military positions making decisions about whether they would do this or not. I find it really interesting about the one that said that, you know, we didn't want to have to possibly quell something of, you know, a riot or an unrest or a protest by civilians. That, you know, today that just doesn't seem, if, I mean, I guess our National Guard would be a comparison today, that they take orders and this is what they have to do. Sounds like it was different at that time.
Well, I know that, okay, you know, after Penrose escaped the Senate chamber, he contacted Rittner, and Rittner basically declared that the mob that was in the Senate chamber caused such a disruption that he needed to call in the militia. And the first units that responded to this crisis were troops out of Philadelphia, commanded by, I believe, a General Patterson. Now, when General Patterson eventually reached, you know, the Capitol, I mean, back then it was, you know, there was no interstate highways and anything like that, so it took some time. When he eventually reached Harrisburg, he basically made it clear to the governor that, hey, I'm not going to have my troops fire upon, you know, unarmed, you know, well, civilians. And I'm not going to try to install, you know, or force the installation of, you know, political figures on either party, you know, and be used that way. It's like, I'm here to protect public property, and my troops will only fire upon civilians if they are threatened. Now, that's a big difference between what happened in D.C. I mean, you know, while there's similarities, there's also differences. The Buckshot War did not produce casualties, reported casualties. At least I didn't see any in my research. You know, Washington, you had the five who were killed in the Capitol complex, and you had untold number of people, you know, you had dozens of people who were injured. You didn't have that with the Buckshot War. It was basically... what happened in the Senate chamber was the crowd was getting increasingly bold as the night wore on. They were getting increasingly rowdy, and they just reached a pivot point where they decided, hey, we're going to break loose and we're going to go after Penrose and these, you know, a couple other Whig politicians. And then Penrose, you know, didn't know what was going to happen. He fled for his life.
So how did
it end? You didn't really see the degree of violence that you saw in Washington.
So how did it end?
The degree of lethal violence.
Mm-hmm. We only have about a minute or so left. How did it end?
Well, I basically reported in my chapter, and I think I reported in my story, that basically they had come to an agreement in the, I think the House agreed to be ruled by Democrats, whereas the Senate was kind of a coalition. So, I mean, in a way, that's kind of another, you know, parallel, because we had the U.S., you know, the Senate runoffs in Georgia that led to a 50-50 split in the U.S. Senate. So in the state kind of situation, you had this coalition of the two parties. And, you know, what's odd is that's what they're trying to work on now in the U.S. Senate, is some sort of agreement between the two parties, you know, and how to rule, how to manage the U.S. Senate. So, you know, a strange way, there's yet another parallel.
Carlisle Sentinel reporter and author of the book Hidden History of Cumberland County, Joseph Kress. Mr. Kress, thank you very much. Fascinating part of Pennsylvania and Cumberland County's role in Pennsylvania history. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
And you too. Want to mention, coming up on Monday, the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania will be with us. We'll be discussing what their legislative priorities are. Counties, we often have a County Commissioners Association on to talk about counties' priorities, because counties don't get as much attention as what some other government bodies do. So, and they are right there, probably working closer with with their constituents than most government entities as well. So County Commissioner Association of Pennsylvania coming up on Monday talking about their legislative proposals and also what they are proposing or at least would like to see with changes and reforms made in election law. That's coming up on Monday. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good weekend.